Welcome to our regular session of the Oro Valley Town Council. I'd like to call the meeting to order. Mr. Standish, roll call.
Mayor Winfield?
Here.
Vice Mayor Barrett?
Here.
Councilmember Jones Ivy?
Here.
Councilmember Nicholson?
Here.
Councilmember Pena?
Here.
Councilmember Rodman?
Here.
Councilmember Solomon?
Here.
Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Mr. Standish will announce upcoming meetings.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. The Town Council will be holding a special session on January 27th at 8 a.m. here in the Council Chambers. The Town Council will also be holding another special session on January 28th, and the time is still to be determined on that one. The Board of Adjustment meeting for January 28th has been canceled. The Historic Preservation Commission will be meeting on February 3rd at 5 p.m. in the Council Chambers. We'll double-check that one. The Water Utility Commission will be having a special session on February 3rd at 5 p.m. in the Council Chambers. Planning and Zoning Commission will be meeting February 4th at 6 p.m. in the Council Chambers. And then the next Town Council regular session will be on February 5th at 6 p.m. right here in the Council Chambers. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Standish. We have this evening, Council Member Jones Ivy will recognize Annalise Perez, a fourth grader at Wilson, and Savannah Dorme, an eighth grader at Wilson. Councilmember Jones Ivy.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And before I do that, I'd like to remind everyone that's here, if you have an opportunity, we're going to have a public meeting on our Parks and Recreation Needs Assessment, and it's going to be held tomorrow evening here at 6 o'clock in the Council Chambers, and I want to encourage you all to come and give us your input. Okay, I've got the privilege of introducing two of the prettiest ladies in the house. Thank you. Okay, I want to ask Annalise Perez, if she'll please come up. It's my honor to introduce you. She is a fourth grader at Wilson, K through 8, and to be such a young woman, she's already done a lot to leave a lasting impression on the Wilson community. As a student council president, Annalise goes above and beyond the average student to promote kindness. She stands up against bullying, includes others in play, and encourages her classmates to accept all students and develop new friendships. Her acts of kindness were recognized when she was in the second grade, when she was presented with the Minnie Benz Bell's Kindness. Annalise's humanity spreads beyond the Wilson community. She also participates in the Red Cross Hurricane Relief Drive by donating her own personal savings to the cause. In addition to her drive to spread kindness, Annalise also enjoys many activities. She plays the cello with the Wilson Orchestra, has participated in the Wilson Choir, and was part of the Oro Valley swim team. Annalise has shown great perseverance in her studies. When she first started Wilson in the first grade, she was a bit behind in her reading level. However, after working 3 years and putting in hard work, she has graduated from the Reading Intervention Program and is now reading at grade level. Congratulations. It's clear that Annalise has the kindest heart, and we are so proud to recognize her as our spotlight on youth, and we wish you the very best. Bye.
Thank you.
Now it's my honor again to introduce another wonderful student from Wilson, Savannah Dorme. She's in the eighth grade at Wilson. Savannah goes above and beyond the average student, and we are here to celebrate her dedication to her community. Not only her community, but her school and extracurricular clubs like the Yearbook Committee and student government. She has served as student council president for 4 years in a row. That's an accomplishment. Savannah is passionate and driven, which is evident as she has participated in 12 musical productions. If that wasn't enough, Savannah is a member of the National Junior Honor Society and is putting together an awareness day for epilepsy. She plans to have this continue each year with other needed awarenesses like autism and diabetes, for example. School administrators have commented on her respectful and responsible character and her investment in making the community a better place each and every day. Savannah, we are so proud to recognize you as our spotlight on youth, and we can't wait to see what your future holds.
Thank you, Councilmember Jones-Ivy. Are there any other council reports?
Nope.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Jacobs will present her report.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of council. Just a reminder that starting on Monday, a segment of La Cholla Boulevard will be closed for about 3 months. This area is south of Lambert. All of the residents and the churches along the stretch will be accommodated. And again, just to explain for the public, this is about safety for the contractors. And also, the good news is it'll save us 6 weeks at the back end. So the sooner we can get La Cholla open, I know that the entire community will be very happy about that. And then, Mr. Mayor, with your permission, I'd like to ask our Parks and Recreation Director to just very briefly talk about our needs assessment and our community outreach process.
You've got it.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. Mayor, Council, as Councilmember Jones-Ivy mentioned, we have a community meeting tomorrow evening here in Council Chambers. It starts at 6 o'clock to kick off the Parks and Recreation Needs Assessment and Master Plan. There'll be about a 30-minute presentation, and then people will be put together in groups, and they'll have some conversation, and they'll be asked questions to answer, and then all that information will be reported out. But that's not the only place to participate. We do have a web page. It is planyourparks, plural, OV.com. planyourparksov.com. Well, I have the mic. I need to promote that. And we've had great participation. There's a section in there that says participate. You can go in there and submit your comments, anything related to parks and recreation in terms of what you want to see in our community for the over the course of the next 5 to 10 years. Furthermore, we will also be participating in several community events, so our consultants will be there, and they'll have an opportunity to contribute information. We will also be developing a randomly selected statistically valid survey that will be launched in through February and March. And then our goal is to have all of those data points put together for a report to the PRAB in April and then to Council in May. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. The agenda will remain as posted. There are no informational items. We'll go to call to audience. Pursuant to the Arizona Open Meeting Law, mayor and council are not allowed to discuss, respond to, or take legal action on matters raised during call to audience. At the conclusion of call to audience, council members may direct town staff to review the matter, ask that the matter be placed on a future agenda, or respond to criticism made by speakers. I have one blue card, Dr. Ted Dressinger.
Thank you, Mayor Winfield and City Council. It's a privilege to be here yet once again to talk about my support of internal hiring for the succession of the Chief of Police. I know it's getting close to making a decision, and I just want to reaffirm that thought process. I also would like to thank the mayor for having a private meeting with me when I asked him for it. He followed up with not only an email, but a call. And so I want to say I appreciate that very much, Mayor Winfield. In the course of that meeting and subsequently, I've come to the understanding that not anybody on the new council has taken the Citizens Academy. That is to say, the Academy for Learning How the Police Department Works here in Oro Valley. I do understand, Mayor Winfield, that you began and had a false start, and you got a second start coming up. But not just because you're on council members, but I'm concerned that as citizens of this community for which you are concerned in general, you have not taken the time to sit through the most amazing, intricate revelation of how our police department operates in town. That's troubling to me. I don't think anybody on the council really understands what it means to be a police officer. Certainly I don't, with the exception of Ms. Jones-Ivy, who spent a career living with a law enforcement officer and knows the heartache and knows the fear and the angst of the morning when she says goodbye to her husband, being unsure whether she will see him for dinner. I've never had that experience, but I was in the military in Vietnam, and I can say that I've had the angst of going to bed at night wondering if I was going to get through the night and whether indeed I was going to show up in the morning. So I have that sense. I want to say about the Citizens Academy that it's just not about law enforcement, but it's a very deliberate model here in Oro Valley. It's finely tuned. It's operated for 2 decades under the very deliberate modeling and tutoring of Chief Sharp. And I just want to say that for anybody who hasn't taken this academy, I really think as a citizen's responsibility, we should all do that. I also would like to quickly address the 4 candidates that now have been made public. 2 of them are retired police officers. The 2 external candidates have been out of law enforcement for at least a year or maybe longer. And that's troubling to me that in a nationwide search for a potential chief of police in Oro Valley, that only 2 external candidates emerged, and both of them were from Arizona, and both of them are retired police officers. Our internal police officer candidates are diverse, they are talented, they are richly involved in the community, they live here, they know the people, they know the process, they know the model, and I would like to urge the council yet once again, when you make the decision next week, that you favorably look at internal candidates. Finally, I'd like to say this, that The advisory council, I'm on the chief's advisory council. I want to be very transparent about that. And I want to say that his advisory council is very much in favor of an internal hire. So I yet once again appreciate the opportunity to stand before the council. I thank you and look forward to your decision next week.
Thank you. I received a second blue card, Mr. Greg Kishi.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and Council. I also agree with the previous speaker. I believe that the uniqueness of our police department is pervasive throughout the department, beginning with dispatch and going all the way through the responding officers. But what I actually took my blue card was I had previously expressed concern with the blue card to this council on not getting the survey results on the police chief hiring process. I would like to thank you for making it public. I believe that that is an important part of having true transparency on your council. Thank you very much.
That concludes call to audience. We'll go to presentations. Mr. Standish.
Presentation of a painting to Chief Sharp by artist and Oro Valley resident Harry Mo Green.
So Councilmember Pena will give a brief background and introduce Mr. Green this evening.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Tonight's presentation for an artist unveiling tonight for our Chief of Police, Chief Sharp, by our artist, Dr. Harry Lamone Green, is going to take place here. And Mr. Harry Lamone Green, he's a doctor, he's been a resident here in Oro Valley since 1989. And this was brought to my attention that he had created his artistry to celebrate our Chief of Police. And unfortunately, it's because you're retiring, but nonetheless, it's a beautiful piece of art. And so I'm going to read Dr. Green's biography because he's very, very accomplished. And given the tenure in this community and along with this special gift that he's going to present, I think it's worth noting. So Harry L. Green II was born May 24, 1942, in Hannibal, Missouri. His father was a physician and his mother a nurse and an amateur artist. She thought nothing of driving him to St. Louis, 2.5 hours away, to view art and to take lessons from visiting artists. Green showed an early interest in art and excelled, winning Helm Art and Scholastic Art Awards as a teenager. After high school, he left his art to weekends and evenings as he pursued his father's career as a physician. He spent 34 years learning and practicing medicine, first as a cancer specialist, Sidney Farber Cancer Institute, Harvard Medical School, then in primary care and prevention, University of Massachusetts, Stanford University, and the University of Arizona. And for 7 years before retiring, he was chief executive staff officer of the Massachusetts Medical Society, a group of 17,000 doctors, and the publisher of the esteemed New England Journal of Medicine. Green has published, edited, or co-edited 5 textbooks on medicine, 4 of which are still in current editions, and 2 on CD-ROM. His favorite aspect of the books was the art and illustrations that brought the dry text to life. In 2001, he left medicine and took intensive lessons to rekindle his latent art skills at the Worcester Art Museum School. In 2002, he moved to Tucson, Arizona, to open his own studio and become a member of the Drawing Studio, an artist cooperative like Art Students League in New York. Green is currently a member and certified instructor for the Portrait Institute of America, John Howard Sandon, the Portrait Society of America, the Southern Arizona Artists Guild, past president, and past president of the Greater Oro Valley Arts Council. His paintings are already in over 100 homes and collections from Maine to Boston and from California to Hawaii. His work has been on exhibit at J&R Gallery, Tucson, Arizona, and the Drawing Studio, also in Tucson, Arizona, Wyatt Earp Gallery in Tucson, or excuse me, Tombstone, the Artist Palette in Tubac, the Seabreeze Gallery in Boston, among others. He currently teaches oil portrait classes in Tucson at Toscana Gallery and at Saddlebrook Ranch in Arizona. He lives here with his wife, Linda, in Oro Valley. Artist statement. I knew as a young artist the pleasure of getting a likeness when attempting a portrait. That feeling is intensified when one can extend it to other media but add to likeness a sense of the character of the person you are painting. when likeness and character are combined with an artistic rendering that stands on its own aesthetics, one has a work of art that will transcend time and bring joy to viewers for generations. This special painting of Police Chief Daniel Sharp was a pleasure to paint, given all he has done for Oro Valley as police chief and as also serving as a town manager. The painting is based on a photo taken by Jennifer LaFave and was named to Protect and Serve by Mary Murphy. So it is my honor to introduce Dr. Green, and then Chief Sharp, would you join Dr. Green for the unveiling?
I'm just sorry my mother wasn't here to hear that. You're a really special guy.
Thank you.
And I'd just like to say it was a joy doing this. Jen LaFave took the picture, and thank you for posing for us. And the name, I think, to serve and protect, characterizes what you've done for our community through the years. So thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you very much.
Councilmember Pena, thank you, Dr. Green. Thank you, Chief Sharp. We'll go to presentation two.
Presentation on the history of Steam Pump Ranch.
Thank you, Mayor, Council. That's a hard act to follow. So, Chief, congratulations.
Very nice.
I'm here to tell a couple stories about Steam Pump Ranch as well. So this evening, let me make sure I have my... This will be essentially the format that we're going to follow. So we'll I'll show you Steam Pump Ranch. We'll go through the Push-Zellweger era, the Proctor-Lieber era, talk a little bit about how we acquired the property, a little about how the Historic Preservation Commission was formed, as well as the Oro Valley Historical Society. Go over some of the acquisition stabilization projects, some events, and then where we're planning on moving forward in the future. So this is an aerial of the ranch, so I want to kind of walk through where what things are. So this right here is where the pump house was. It's currently a ghosted structure, and I'll go into that a little bit later. This is the push house. This is the 1980s home that has been restored. This area is the garage. This is the Proctor-Lieber house. And this is the pool that they built. And this is what we call the backyard, but was their front yard. I missed it. Over here, and between on either side of these two trees are two bunk houses. This area right here is the barbecue and also the caretaker's home. And the caretaker was Carlos, so sometimes it's referred to as Carlos's house as well. This area is the shade structure for the marketplace. That is not part of the historically significant facilities, but it is just in terms of understanding where pieces of the property are. Underneath these trees are where the chicken coops are. Here's our restroom. And then kind of if it were wider, right here would be where the loop is, the linear path. For the north of here, up in this area, are the stables. When we talk about the historically significant portion of the property, that is basically where this grass line is, comes up to Carlos's house, around the chicken coops, down into like this, past the push house, and then around, and then back up. So those are the historically significant pieces that were contributing factors to the us being part of the National Registry. So this is the Push Zellweger area. So I'm going to tell a story. And when I started this, it's, you know, this started in the 1800s, so it's hard to consolidate this to a short presentation because there's a lot of stories and a lot of families. So for those of you here and in the audience that are interested, there are two great places you can go. You can go to the Town of Oro Valley's website under the history section. There's a lot of stories there. And the Oro Valley Historical Society's website also has a lot of history. So both of those two sites, if you really want to dive into this. This is definitely very, very high level for the sake of time. This picture is, oh dear, excuse me. So this is Matilda. This is George Push's wife. This is George Jr. This is George Push. And this is their daughter, Gertrude. And hidden under here is their little doggy. I don't know what his name is, though. So George Push moved to the United States from Germany in 1965. And he moved to New York, became a butcher. Oh, excuse me, 1865. Excuse me, I even have that on my notes. I'm telling you, it's a long story. And he met in New York a man by the name of John Zellweger. They became friendly, but they parted ways because George wanted to move out west because he was a cattleman. So he moved to Tucson, but George and John connected back in Tucson again in 1874. They decided to settle at what is now known as the Steam Pump Ranch. And they registered the P&Z cattle brand, and that's right up there. That's what there is, a P and hanging Z. The ranch known as the Steam Pump Ranch was also used, where the steam pump is, was also a blacksmith shop. A few years later, John sold his share to George Push, and John moved on to Florence to run the Teacup Ranch in Florence. George and Matilda Feldman, married in April of 1881. They had 9 children, and 7 of those children survived. Oracle, which then was the part of the Apache Trail, and ranches along that trail would be attacked periodically by the Apaches, but Steam Pump Ranch never was. John and his family made a relationship with the Native Americans, and they traded flour and sugar. And there are stories where some of the younger children were out hiking and would run into the Apaches, and they would bring her in as a friend and then get her back home safely. George, even though selling cattle was what they did, they, you know, filled them up with water and sent them off because they were nice and fat and heavy, he decided that he was going to run a butcher shop because there was more profit in a butcher shop than selling cattle. So he did that down in Tucson. Then he engaged in politics. So George was a member of the territorial legislature in 1891 and also in 1899. He was also a member of the Constitutional Convention in 1910 for Pima County. He would not sign the Constitution because of a provision that said public officials, including judges, would be subject to a recall. The Constitution passed, Arizona became a state, February 14th, 1912. A few months later, that same year, that provision was restored. George passed away in 1921, and Martha passed away in 1933. The Proctor-Lieber era. So Jack Proctor and his wife, this is Jack right here with the prize bull, his wife Elizabeth, they moved to Tucson from California in 1932, and Jack was moved here to manage the Pioneer Hotel. Through that process, he ended up purchasing a small part of Steam Pump Ranch in 1937 and then made the final purchase in 1943. Jack is the one that built that large Proctor-Lieber house, and he bought it for his family, but he also bought it to entertain the prestigious hotel guests so they would come and have this ranching experience. in the chicken coops, he raised chickens and eggs, and that would those were used down in the hotel. And he raised prize bulls. Jack also built that large barbecue for another entertainment area. He was quite the entertainer, but then later enclosed it to become the caretaker's house. Jack and Elizabeth had a daughter by the name of Betty. Betty's there on the right, and she was striking. She had this vibrant red hair and just fiery personality. She was quite the looker. And so she caught the eye of U of A baseball player, Hank Lieber. And they got married sometime in the 30s. I wasn't able to find the exact year, but in the 1930s they got married. So Lieber was a prominent baseball player, played for Chicago Cubs and the New York Giants between 1933 and 42. He was also instrumental in bringing spring training baseball to Tucson in the 1950s. Steam Pump Ranch became the party place during spring training for all the baseball players. This is where they would come. So we have a rich baseball history here as well. Jack died in 1972. I was unable to find out when Betty passed, but the ranch ownership transitioned to his two grandsons, John and Harry. John and Cheryl Lieber lived in that home until the town purchased it in 2007. So that puts us to the acquisition. So how we acquired this property was through the 2004 Pima County bond project. And so there was $2 million earmarked for the acquisition of Steam Pump Ranch. Also in that bond, there was another $3 million for land acquisition north of Naranja town site. However, the land cost was skyrocketing. And so the area that was identified became greater than that $3 million. So town manager and town council requested that the county move funds from Naranja to Steam Pump Ranch for that acquisition. Again, land prices went up. We purchased that property for $4.5 million. We have an intergovernment agreement with the county to manage that property, as well as a historic preservation easement. And that's really to ensure that we're good stewards in terms of the architecture, the historic landscape, and the cultural features to the site. Shortly after we purchased that, these two groups formed. So the first group all on the left, the Historic Preservation Commission, and so that's the commission that reports ultimately to council, and that was adopted in 2006. And their mission is to promote the education, culture, and economic welfare of the town of Oro Valley by ensuring the preservation of historic buildings, districts, landmarks, structures, documents, photographs, and other artifacts that represent the historic background and development of the greater Oro Valley area. So preservation is key to what their role and function is. The Oro Valley Historical Society was incorporated in 2005. Their mission is to promote research, preservation, education, and dissemination of history related to the greater Oro Valley area. They also are a 501c3 organization, so they have the ability to do fundraising efforts in terms of having tax benefits for folks. We do have a great partnership and relationship with the Oro Valley Historical Society. I'm going to jump back to that picture real quick because I neglected to tell you. Oops. This area right here is the historic garden, and this is managed by the Oro Valley Historical Society. So they take care of everything in here. There's also a pit house where the Historical Society and the town partner with Archaeology Southwest to do some education and interpretive work as well. So let me jump back to where we were in our storytelling. Acquisition and improvements. So I'm going to go over some dates, but you know, I thought pictures were much better than seeing a bunch of words and numbers up there. So that's just how I present. So the property was acquired in 2007 to 2010. We did site cleanup and roadway and gardens. The first master plan was developed in 2008. The Push House restoration took place in 2010. We were put on the National Historic Register in 2009. We installed that restroom in 2012, and that restroom was actually funded as part of the loop extension. So the multi-use path coming sort of, say, down from the marketplace area stopped, and then you had to go down into the wash and then come back up to the ramp just on sort of the backside of where Home Depot is. That extension was completed, hold on, in 2014. In 2013, we added that Ramada shade structure and pulled electrical in there. And we also did a condition assessment in 2014. In 2015, we updated the conceptual master plan. The Push House preservation treatment, that ghosted structure, was done in 2015. The landscape plan and irrigation and grass installation started in 2016. We did additional surface treatment stabilization in 2017, did a push house repair in 18, chicken coop preservation in 18-19, and some electrical and additional landscape. So those are, I'm going to kind of walk you through this. So here is our entry arch that was done. This is all of the cyclists that were there the day we had the loop project completed. And then here's the farmer's market. And as you can see, this is the structure that we installed for that. This is a picture of the adobe steam pump house, as well as where the blacksmith shop was. The ghosted structure, really, what it does is it mimics the footprint of what this was. So you can get a visual. Underneath here are essentially ruins of the pump house. This is the chicken coop repair, and so we did. We received a grant from the State Historic Preservation Office, SHPO, to do a lot of this repair. And so they paid for a lot of materials, but we also brought in an adobe expert, and we taught volunteers how to repair the adobe, because it will continue to deteriorate. So now we have a nice workforce of volunteers that can help continue to preserve this facility. The push house repairs were done. There used to be a large tree, let me make sure I'm hitting the right, kind of about here, and it died, so the root system started to atrophy, so we had a little sinking issue. So we did a lot of repair work here. And then this is just a picture of the difference between having a beautiful grass lawn and playability and visual, but also in terms of dust mitigation, because before we put that grass in there, we had a lot of concern with just dust and dirt dried up and, you know, the wind. And so that was really a game changer in terms of the experience that you have at Steam Pump Ranch, was adding in the landscape. And programs and events. We have started from 1 to 2 events out there a year. When we installed the shade structure for the farmers market, we have 52 events a year. They're there every weekend. Last year we had 84. This year we're tracking 98. So over the course of the work that's been done out there in terms of stabilization, landscape, the thought was the more people we can get out there and have a great experience and introduce them to Steam Pump Ranch, the more interest we'll have in terms of now what are we going to do in terms of stabilization and preservation of the building. So we've made really good strides, and this is an incredibly popular location. Looking forward, we're going to continue with the programming, second Saturdays, a concert series, youth events, special events, community events, and then the preservation. So, of course, the landscape plan, the garage. We have worked with the Historical Society to garner some great information related to the garage and for its future use. Addressing the barbecue area, the Proctor Lieber House, the bunk houses, and then the push house security system. key things. So this year in our CIP, we have, there's $100,000 earmarked in capital for Steam Pump Ranch. So we presented to the Historic Preservation Commission. Our recommendation actually was to start working on the barbecue piece, just to do some work and stabilization. But the Historic Preservation Commission wanted to focus more so on the sprinkler system and security system at the push house. So that's what we're going to do this year. And then we'll continue to do some work with the landscape this year. We also received a grant, a SHPO grant. You all approved that a few months ago, to do an adaptive reuse analysis. So we are hiring someone to identify the other buildings that are out there. What's the best and highest use in terms of long-term sustainability for that property? Because we've had, over the course of the past few years, a handful of people approach us, private dollars, to say, hey, what can we do to invest in this property and in terms of a public-private partnership? And that's a very long process. You have to go through an RFP, et cetera. And until we really have a true understanding of what is feasible, we don't know what to ask for. So this adaptive reuse study will help us get to that point. And then, of course, as part of the park and recreation needs assessment, we'll be revisiting the conceptual site plan of Steam Pump Ranch, and then likely the information from that analysis will be in, so we'll be able to start matching some things up and have all of that data put together. Lastly, just continuing to work with the Historic Preservation Commission in terms of identifying and prioritizing future funds. And so with that, I am open for questions.
Councilmember Solomon.
Hi. Could we go back to the picture of the push pump structure?
Yes. This one?
Yes. Now, do you know when the photo on the year the photo on the left-hand side was taken?
I don't know when it was taken. I'm looking at Linnan, at my
right.
resident expert.
I do know that there are some photos that look similar taken in the 50s and the 70s. So I'm guessing because of the color, probably this is a 70s photo.
Okay, I mean, all I want to do is point out is this is what happens when the structures aren't preserved. You could effectively see that there's nothing left of that structure. There's a tiny little corner of the adobe wall. And one of the things we really need to pay attention to is preserving the structures so that we don't get this type of deterioration, because once it's gone, for example, the Steam Pump Ranch, that's what housed the steam pump. It's gone. It's no longer there. So that's one of the things that the town and the council needs to pay attention to. It's a little bit of a difficult topic because there's fairly high costs associated with preserving the buildings or restore, you know, to first preserve them so that there's not any further deterioration. And then, of course, the next step is to restore them and restore them historically, and that can be quite expensive. But we got to make sure. We've had a lot of trouble with the Proctor Lieber House, with the roof collapsing, losing the second floor, and things like that. So it's something I think we need to take a serious look during this budget process this year as to what money do we really need. You know, $50,000, $100,000 a year is just not doing it, and it won't do it to try to protect the buildings. And once again, foremost, our obligation is the preservation. We got to stop any future deterioration, and once it's stabilized, then we need to look at restoration. And if anyone's interested and hasn't been there, the Push Ridge House is a perfect example of that. That was restored in 2010. It's amazing. It attracts a large number of visitors. And also, the other side of the equation is, yes, using the facility. Steam Pump Ranch is known by a lot of the public now. We had a major Halloween event there. The more people that visit and utilize the site, the more awareness it raises, the more it enlightens people as to the need for putting the dollars into the ranch to make sure that it's here 10, 20 years down the road. And you can see what happens in a short, it's amazing, in the short period of time. Because, yeah, I understood that to be at least in the 70s because of the quality and the color of the photo. And you would say, oh, it's going to be there for a while, but it was gone. So that's all. I just want to make comments, and it's something I think we need to take a closer look at and get recommendations from Parks and Rec and the Historic Preservation Commission on what type of resources do we need to start putting in the Steampunk Ranch to make sure it is preserved.
Thank you.
Other council members? Vice Mayor Barrett?
Thanks. That was a good presentation. I enjoyed it. Do you have any more insight as to how the Parks and Rec needs assessment will be looking at Steampunk Ranch in particular, since that seems to be a little bit different in character from a lot of our projects? And I don't know if the public at large necessarily associates Steampunk Ranch with Parks and Recreation in the same way they would a playground or a field.
Yes. So it'll likely be linked in terms of the programming. So if there's a desire for more, say, outdoor art and doing landscapes, that would be a location to do it versus, say, at Naranja Park. You still have great views, but that could be a location. We are very limited in terms of putting anything new on the property because of the historic significance. But what you do inside the buildings, there's a lot of flexibility. The treatment is really about the exterior. So I'm hopeful that the adaptive reuse project will glean some light and help us with that as well. Furthermore, just real quick, so three of our community outreach events will be at Steampunk Ranch as part of the needs assessment project.
Okay, and then will there be any questions on the statistically valid survey? Because I would be interested in having a little more data and information about, you know, the priority that residents place on, say, with Steampunk Ranch, we have events versus we have historical preservation versus we have the security systems. And we've kind of talked about how there's a multitude of different priorities. And I would be curious if we could, you know, garner some more data about how the residents feel about those various priorities.
I'll work with our consultant on that and see what his thoughts are. He's done projects like this, you know, hundreds throughout, and I'm sure that he's encountered historic districts and historic buildings and facilities. So I'll ask him what his, you know, some best practices are that we can certainly strive to get that level of detail.
Okay, thanks. I'm sure you're welcome. All important, but just in terms of helping us to prioritize those things.
It is, indeed, because there's a lot of competition and we want it all.
Just one. Are there any other council members that have questions? Councilmember Jones Ivey.
With all of the activities that are going on out there on a weekly basis, is this generating monies that can go towards getting some of this work done?
So activities that we put on, the Town of Oro Valley mm-hmm. staff puts on, and there's a fee that goes back into the general fund. If there's a rental, so the wedding rental, mm-hmm. just as in people rent a park or rent pool space, that goes back into the general fund. So it is treated in terms of revenue expense, much like our ball fields are and our, you know, a remodel rental, for example. That's where, you know, working with nonprofits would be helpful because they would have an ability to do some fundraising.
So, Christy, you're saying that the funds go into the general funds, but mm-hmm, we are not tracking how much is being generated by Steampunk Ranch?
We know. We know how much, like, rental rates that we get that we receive from people that rent space at Steampunk Ranch. We know that, but it goes back into the general fund, just as we know how much rental comes in at, say, Naranja Park Sports Field. That goes back into the general fund. It doesn't go back into a Naranja Park fund.
Okay, so is it possible to get some of these funds, and I'm not sure who would answer this question, is it possible to get some of those funds that the site is generating put into some of the fixtures that needed?
Mr. Mayor, Councilmember Jones, Ivy, what we do is we assess the needs of each of the facilities and measure them against our total resources that we have available. So, yes, we do know how much comes in, but remember, we also have to maintain it just in terms of staff and regular maintenance. And so I can assure you we're already spending more at that facility than we get. Okay. And so we have been, in fact, Christy and I have spoken about, you know, what are those next steps and what do we need to do? And it is important that we have that good plan and that it be an attainable plan, but it's going to be a bit of chipping away process to get to some of these things. But, you know, we've heard from the council that it's a priority. Yes, we heard last year about this time from our first flash vote survey that we have a very large participation at that facility. So we will be looking at what we can include in next fiscal year's budget to make some of the improvements that that our Parks and Recreation director mentioned.
And what have we allocated for this fiscal year?
In terms of capital dollars, yes. $100,000.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Councilmember Solomon.
Right. When the town acquired this, it was through Pima County bond funds. So basically, Pima County paid for it, and it was given or transferred to Oro Valley with an intergovernmental agreement, which put certain obligations on the town. Pima County has a conservation easement. So what are the main obligations that the town has regarding Steam Pump Ranch?
That we protect and preserve. I mean, in a nutshell, those are the pieces that we need to do. We when it was acquired and we had the master plan, it was an aggressive master plan, but also we had a really aggressive economy rolling around, and shortly thereafter, everything took a dive. And so I think that now, you know, we've made incremental improvements out there, and there are more people using the space that are enjoying the space, and now that I think that there's some really good community awareness that that we're able to, in a sense, where people would see the more people would see that their dollars are being put in a usable space that would be of value for our community. Uh-oh. You doing okay over there, Councilmember Solomon?
Okay. The point being that we're obligated contractually and I say morally to preserve. So it's great to have citizen input, but if citizen input ranks preservation at the bottom of the list, we can't ignore that. We are obligated to put preservation at the top of the list as far as the property goes. And that's just the point I wanted to make out, because that's an obligation we undertook and agreed to when the property was given to the town of Oro Valley. So that needs to be met, even if it's, quote, at the bottom of the statistically valid survey. It's really irrelevant because we are under obligation to preserve this property. I would like to see the residents recognize the value of it, but it's just a point I wanted to make that we're contractually obligated to preserve this property.
Thank you.
Councilmember Nicholson.
First of all, thanks for the presentation. And then another thing, too, for the citizens, like remodeling these places, it's not like your home where you fix the roof for $15,000. I mean, these projects are several hundred thousand dollars to millions of dollars. So one of the questions, I know when I looked at several months ago, 8 months ago or whatever, when Paul Loomis did his speech, there's historic preservation grants through the state. I think it's like $500,000, a couple million, and I don't know if the federal funds, if there's ways that we, I know that we can't line item request it through the state, but those funds are in like an account and people compete for them. I don't know if how we can try and compete for those or if there's anything the council can do to try and make requests to state representatives in National Congress or State Congress to try and get some of those funds or...
So we do have a certified grant professional on our staff that is that gets all of those pieces of information. And so as things come up that we would qualify for, because there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of factors in order to be able to qualify for certain things, then we do apply. We've been most successful with the SHPO grants, the State Historic Preservation Grants. And so that was, again, how the chicken coops piece was. We got a portion of that for this shaded structure, for this adaptive reuse study. So, but they're smaller in nature. They're not significant in terms of the treatment of one of the structures. Yeah. But we do look. Thank you.
The Heritage Fund is managed through Arizona State Parks. Mm-hmm. It was reinstated. That may not be exactly the terminology, but not funded.
Right.
And recently we did meet with Senator Leach and Representative Fincham and Roberts advocating that it be funded. So we Excellent. Hope that happens. And anyone that has an interest, if you want to reach out to your state legislatures, that would be welcomed. Christy, the adaptive reuse analysis, what will that be completed?
It'll be completed before the end of the fiscal year. We are working on getting a contractor on board, and then we want to have that align with the needs assessment data collection that is happening with the master plan. So the goal is to have that be done before the end of the fiscal year.
Okay. Councilmember Rodman?
Just, I know this is a presentation, and we're kind of getting into what we may see in the budget process, but to Steve's point about contractually obligated, can you give me the minute and a half what that means, what we're contractually obligated to do? I think that would help mm-hmm. me understand what our choices are and what our choice is, the minimum kind of. I know we've done a little here, a little there, and evidently that's been okay so far, but at what point do we run into a problem that we're not doing enough on preservation, et cetera?
So, I'll jump to the preservation easement, and this will kind of, again, big picture. It's to assure that the architecture, history, landscape, and cultural features of the site will be retained and maintained forever. So, high level, they want to make sure that we're not going to bulldoze it and put soccer fields there. That's what we're contractually obligated to ensure its historic integrity and to restore the buildings. Not restore, excuse me, preserve the buildings because some can't be restored.
So this is the language in the contract?
That's the language in the easement that is included in the contract, yes.
Okay. So it's pretty subject to interpretation what that means, isn't it? Okay, thank you.
Christy, I neglected. I have a blue card, Mr. Eric Thomas, and I intended to invite Mr. Thomas up earlier, but if you would come up and take your 3 minutes.
Can I admit I'm a 50-year-old who's almost giddy right now? Almost 50, because you guys are talking about this, and I really appreciate it. My name's Eric Tomei. I'm a resident of Oro Valley for more than 10 years, and I'm also past chair of the Historic Preservation Commission, and I'm just beginning this month my third term as a commissioner. I come on my own behalf, not on behalf of the commission. I'm going to do this as fast as I can. A lot of what I drafted has been discussed, and I really appreciate it. I spoke to the town council about steam pump in 2014, and it was prior to putting the ghosted structure over the steam pump building. Unfortunately, as you saw, it was a ruin at that time, and there was talk about bulldozing it over. And it's the namesake of the property. I appreciate Councilman Solomon's comments on that because that's extremely important. But in that time in 2014, I mentioned to the council that they had an obligation under the Pima County easement. And the actual language, I quoted it, the actual language is to assure the architectural, historic, landscape and cultural features of the site will be retained and maintained forever, substantially in their current or better condition for conservation and preservation purposes. And it's my opinion that that hasn't been followed. We've done little bits and pieces, but it has not been followed. And you ask, where do we kind of stand with that? 4 years ago, we weren't in great standing with Pima County. They wanted to see a lot more done than what was being done. There's also a master plan. That master plan was done in 2008. Paul Loomis was the mayor. There are Historic Preservation Commission members and Coral Valley Historical Society members that put together that master plan. That master plan had a pre-opening phase, a opening phase, and a build-out phase. We are still in the pre-opening phase. It was supposed to be done in 2009. Unfortunately, the first priority of that pre-opening phase was to stabilize the site and threatened structures. There are still threatened structures out there. There are structures that continue to deteriorate and fall apart. Main reason I wanted to come, and we actually, when I was on the commission in 2014, we asked for an assessment, condition assessment, to find out what structures needed at first. We got some of that work done. That entire assessment, though, talked about temporary stabilization. It anticipated full stabilization by 2017. We're nowhere near that. My final comments in 30 seconds. I appreciate the desire for fire suppression system, a security system, but that wasn't in the priority list. I think we got hijacked. The commission, while I was off, got hijacked. And we're not saving the buildings. We are focused solely on that push building, and it's the one that's stabilized the most. I would love to speak with any of you individually. I'm passionate about this, as you can tell. And I just think we've got to save the buildings first. Thank you.
Thank you. Any additional questions?
Mr. Mayor, do you have a
Councilmember
question?
Pena?
This is going to be towards Christy. And you may not have the answer to this, but you mentioned that the original purchase was 4.6, and that was part of the bonds, and the bonds are $5 million, according to that figure. So do we know where the difference was? Was there any monies put back into steam pump at that time?
Councilmember Pena, it was used for the cleanup and the start of the restoration.
Okay. Okay. All that difference. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Christy, we really appreciate your presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I know talk is cheap, but I think there's a real opportunity for some partnership-ing opportunities with Pima County, with Arizona State Parks, and some federal agencies to help provide some investment into Steam Pup Ranch. Okay, we'll go to presentation three.
Presentation and discussion on the town's comprehensive annual financial report for the fiscal year ending June 30th, 2019.
Okay, so Mr. Arts will introduce the presenter.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Yes, Mr. Christopher Heinfeld with Heinfeld Meach & Company is here. He was the audit partner for our engagement, and he will go over our financial statements and the audit opinion and be available to council for any questions that you may have.
All right, thank you, Mayor, council members, for giving me this opportunity to present to you this evening on the town's fiscal year 19 comprehensive annual financial report. Basically put the financial statements of the town for fiscal year 19. I'm going to...
There's a button where you can raise the platform. Right there you go. So you won't have to be...
It's maxed out. I'll try to move this. There, hopefully that's a little better. I'm just going to briefly go through the report, point out a few key sections, and then also focus on a little bit about our audit procedures throughout the year, and then, as mentioned, open it to any questions, comments that you have at that point. This was my first year as the audit partner on this engagement. I've been with our firm for about 13 years now, but again, this was my first year, at least, as the audit partner. So to begin with, there's three main sections of the comprehensive annual financial report. You have your introductory section, your financial section, and your statistical section. The introductory section includes a transmittal letter, really just a letter from management of the town to the board members as well as other readers of the financial statements. Additionally, in the introductory section, there's the list of principal officials, as well as an organization chart and the prior year's GFOA certificate. The next section, which is sort of the meat and potatoes of the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, or CAFR, is the financial section. Various components there. The first one is the auditor's report, then it's management's discussion and analysis, the basic financial statements, which include the note disclosures, as well as the required supplementary information, and then additional financial statement information. I'm going to briefly go over each of those sections. The audit opinion this year, we issued what we call an unmodified, unqualified audit opinion, basically a clean audit opinion noting that the financial statements do not contain any material weaknesses. Additionally, I'll point your attention to the last paragraph on that audit opinion. We included what we call an emphasis of matters paragraph. It's a change in accounting principles. This year, GASB statement number 88 was required to be implemented by the town, and it was. Really, all that statement did is require some additional note disclosures regarding direct borrowing or direct debt. And so I'll point out when we get to that section in the exact page number, but you'll notice that your debt is being now reported not just in total for revenue bonds, but split out between what's a public offering and what's a private offering or a private placement. And then additionally, with that audit opinion, it touches on the various other aspects of the report. The next section is the management's discussion and analysis section. This is a great section if you're looking for trend information from year to year. Really highlights the key financial information for the current year and maybe what changed from the current year to the prior year. And then we jump into the basic financial statements. The first two pages of those financial statements focus on the town as a whole. And then we get into the other numerous pages of financial statements, which look at the individual funds. Lastly, as part of the basic financial statements, we have the note disclosures, which get into describing some of the key nuances with the account balances and whether there's been any aggregation of accounts on certain line items in the financial statements. The next section is the required supplementary information, some budget schedules and some required pension and OPEB schedules in there. And then the last part of the financial section is you're combining in individual statements and schedules in which we list out all the individual funds of the town, as well as their asset and liability balances, revenue and expenditure balances, and the comparison of those expenditure balances and revenue balances to budgeted amounts. Lastly is the statistical section. This is one of my favorite sections just because it has a lot of great 10-year trend information. You can see some financial statement 10-year trend information, as well as just some demographic or economic information as well. Moving on, just to briefly talk about our audit, various planning procedures are performed during the audit. One is meeting with a council member, in which myself and one of our other auditors met with Mayor Winfield this year. Before we really jumped into the audit, we really planned the engagement from there on out, what test work procedures we're going to do based on the balances or accounts we know that the city or the town has. Next, we move into the actual field work or on-site phases. We were on site 2 different weeks, 3 to 4 individuals each week working with management. And then lastly are some of our wrap-up procedures, which involve compiling the report, getting representations from management, giving presentations like this. And then also, I believe it's gotten to you eventually, we're required to make communications with the town council, the governing body of the entity. In these communications, it's a 3-page letter. It really just outlines if we had any disagreements with management, if we had any specific audit adjustments that we felt necessary to disclose to you, and if we encountered any difficulties during the audit. Those are some of the highlights. It also includes the engagement letter that was signed at the beginning of the audit, as well as the representation letter that was signed at the end of the audit. At this point, I'll open it up to any questions or comments you have.
Council? Councilmember Rodman?
Yeah, it's just to underline something which I think is important to say again, which is the audit of the town's comprehensive annual financial report for June 30, 2019 was complete on December 19, 2019. The town received an unqualified parentheses, clean, close parentheses, audit opinion. In addition, the auditors have indicated there are no management letter findings for the year ended June 30, 2019. I know you said that in, as you went through it, but to me, that's where the eyes go right away. Where, if anything, do we have issues? Might we have issues? I know in last night's budget and finance, there were some questions about, you know, were there recommendations on this or that or something else. So I think you did have some recommendations, which you've talked with Mr. Arts and the staff about. But it's a clean opinion, and there's no management letter involved. And that's – thank you. Congratulations to the staff and to all who worked on it. Thank you.
Councilmember Pena.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And I want to echo Councilmember Rodman's comments. So thank you, staff, for a clean audit. And thank you for the work that you do. I know there's a lot of work that goes into completing these audits, and it's very time intensive for the staff on top of all the other things that you're doing. So thank you. And you mentioned, Councilmember Rodman, that it pretty much is a clean audit. On the audit approach, were there any differences that you took this year in the approach of how you did the due diligence compared to any other years in the past? Or is it pretty much the same?
Overall, it was very similar to what we've done in the past. Going into it, we knew that the Arizona Department of Revenue was issuing confirmation statements a little different this year compared to prior years. So we made sure we were aware of that. I believe last year we had noted that there was an issue with impact fee credits maybe not being properly adjusted for initially in the financial statements. And so we were made sure that we were aware of that and knew what to look for this year. But generally, overall, Councilmember Pena and Mayor, the approach was the same.
Okay, thank you.
I'd just like to acknowledge that we have our chair and vice chair of our Budget and Finance Commission here this evening. I want to recognize them and the other commission members for their review of the audit and their remarks that were made last night. And I also want to recognize Mr. Arts and his staff for your work, Kevin. If there was a steep learning curve, you've made it look pretty shallow as you've come into the town. So we really appreciate your leadership. Thank you so much. I don't see any additional questions. Mr. Heinfeld, thank you. We appreciate your diligent work.
Great. Thank you very much. And my contact information is up there. If any of you want to reach out to me, I will more than willing be available and talk to you, probably more than you'd bargain for, but I'm definitely available to all the council members. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Presentation four.
Presentation and possible discussion of the town's fiscal year 2019-20 financial update through November 2019.
So Mr. Arts will present this item.
Thank you, Mayor. Good evening, Mayor and Council. Staff is here tonight to provide an update on our financial position through November of 2019. For this month, our revenues year-to-date through November are $16.2 million. That compares to last year at this time where we were at $15.3 million. And our total budget is $39.4 million. So we're at 41.2% of our budget in the general fund on the revenue side. On a straight line basis, that's coming in very good. But then also December and January are typically our largest months as far as sales tax collections. So as we make these presentations over the next 2 months, we would anticipate seeing some significant increases in our revenues. But we are projecting those in our year-end estimates at this point. On the expenditure side, we're currently at $16.8 million of expenditures year-to-date. Last year we were at $15.8 million, and our total budget is $41.9 million. and we're projecting to come in under budget on the expenditure side by about $300,000 at this time. So some of the highlights in the general fund, local sales tax collections are estimated to exceed budget by about $1.7 million this year. That's a 8.7% increase over budget. And this is primarily due to increased activity in construction sales tax, but then also on the retail sales tax side, we're seeing increases from some of the online vendors and them starting to pay taxes on internet sales that we hadn't seen in past years. So we are seeing some significant gains in our sales tax collections from those two items. Our license and permit revenues are estimated to exceed budget by approximately $300,000 or 14.7%, and this is due to residential and commercial building and grading permits that we're seeing coming in. Interest income is estimated to exceed budget by $441,000 in the general fund. This is due to better than expected interest earnings. So for the year, we only budgeted $150,000 of interest earnings in the general fund. And part of that is because of the way we were recording our investments in the past. We were waiting till year end to make an adjustment. And so now we're posting our revenue on a monthly basis. And so it'll be easier for us to budget in the future. So this year, when we put the budget together, we'll budget more appropriately on those investment earnings, and they'll be up in the $400,000 to $500,000 range instead of the $150,000 that we budgeted this year. And then expenditures are estimated to end the year under budget by about $320,000, mainly due to some personnel savings that we have, turnover. And then year-end fund balance is estimated to be $19.7 million. So from the audit that we just reviewed, our actual fund balance at June 30, 2019 is $19.5 million. We're estimating that to go up slightly to $19.7 million. Again, that's a very early estimate, and as we get a couple of more months behind us, we'll continue to update that number. In our highway user revenue fund, this is also the gas tax fund. So the revenue that we receive from the state through the gasoline tax collections. Revenues in here are $1.8 million for the year compared to $1.5 million. And we budgeted $3.8 million for the entire fiscal year. On the expenditure side, we're at $1.2 million expenditures year to date compared to $1.1 last year. And 4.1 on a budget basis. So our HERF gas tax revenues are expected to come in over budget by about $200,000. This has been explained in each of the last monthly updates that we gave you, but there was a one-time distributions to cities and towns of HERF revenues that was approved in the state budget that we're receiving this year that we hadn't budgeted for. So we're expecting total revenues to come in over budget in the HERF fund by almost $300,000, and it's primarily due to that increase in the HERF revenues and some other miscellaneous revenue sources that we have in that fund. Expenditures at this time are estimated to come in right at budget, and we're projecting year-end fund balance to be $820,000. In our community center fund, revenues are up slightly from last year. So last year at this time, we had $2.4 million of revenue. This year, we're at $2.5 million. And we have a total budget of $6.7 million in revenues for the community center. On the expenditure side, expenditures are tracking similar to last year at $2.7 million of expenditures and a budget of $6.5 million. So revenues are estimated to exceed budget by about $190,000 in the community center fund. That's about 2.8%, and it's due primarily to operating revenues related to outside play on the member core. So the day play revenue, we are seeing increases in that this fiscal year over what we saw last fiscal year. Expenditures are estimated to come in under budget by roughly $68,000 or 1.1%. and we are projecting that total revenues will exceed our expenditures in the fund by about $550,000. We currently have a $490,000 fund balance in that fund. So when we add those savings to it, we're projecting year-end fund balance to be right at $1.1 million, which is consistent with the number that we presented in the past on the pay-as-you-go financing. So that number is coming in right where we believed it would. So with that, staff is available for any questions that you may have on the financial performance.
Questions from council, comments? Vice Mayor Barrett.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate the presentation of the financials. I just had a question about the capital projects that we've budgeted for in this year's budget. In our previous year budget, there were several capital projects that didn't get completed and ended up being budgeted for again in this year's budget. Are we on pace this year to be able to complete the capital projects and spend that capital money that we've budgeted? Or do we have any projects that are sort of lagging to where we might have that similar expectation where they may come into next year's budget?
Mayor and Vice Mayor Barrett, I haven't looked into specifics of the capital projects, but I can tell you in my experience from other communities, typically your capital projects don't get completed within a fiscal year, and it is quite common that they get started 1 year and then you roll the funds over to the next year. But I do not know any specifics on our capital projects here at Oro Valley, but I can definitely look into that for you. And I know we will be doing a quarterly capital project update, and I know our senior budget analyst is working on that now, so we can get that information to you.
Okay, sure. Yeah, if you wouldn't mind just getting that to me, I'd be interested in knowing kind of the mid-year update of where those stand. Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Councilmember Pena.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Arts, on the online sales tax collection, so while it's only November, and you mentioned we're not really sure of what we're going to be getting from that, how are you looking at that as far as projecting maybe what we'll be doing by year end? Because it's a flexible number, not real sure. How are you forecasting or budgeting?
Right. So we do try to be conservative since we're only 5 months into the year. And as I mentioned earlier, December and January are our largest months when it comes to retail sales tax collections. So by the time we get into the budget process, we will have 2 to 3 more months of the sales tax collections, and we'll have a better estimate of that. But we'll have either 6 to 7 months of those revenues for the year, and then we will project that going forward. It is something that we're seeing as an increase. We expect it to continue, so I would anticipate that we will be showing that as ongoing revenue that will be available from those sources that we haven't received in the past.
Yeah, it'll be curious because if we have some seasonality in some of the retail because of summertime and whatnot, if the online sales make a difference, right, where the seasonality where we wouldn't always have it because people are gone, but yet we get online.
Right.
Revenue. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Councilmember Rodman.
And this has now been 3 years of this, and I'm just now asking the question. Sort of how slow I am. When you get the reports, you give us a percentage of the revenues that have collected or the expenditures up through, in this case, the end of November. That's fine, and I could do the math to decide, well, it's 5 months, and that's a certain percentage, and therefore it's on target or it's not on target or it's too much, it's too little. But I never see that. In other words, you go into what you're projecting for the end of the year based on what's happened in the first 5 months in this case. But it isn't whether, we're on target in that particular paragraph. This is what we expected. We expected it to be higher than normal because this is the time of year we collect a lot more money. Or, something that says, that relates that percentage to what did we expect. Now, that's just me. And I'm sure you've been doing this forever, and I've read it forever, and I've had this question forever. You give me the piece of it that I really want, which is end of year projections, but it doesn't tell me really where we are. Are we where we thought we'd be in 5 months in? And kind of the major things. Just a comment. I don't want to change the world or change your world, but it is something that I've had to do the math each time to figure out whether we're kind of on that five-month percentage. And if not, do I want to ask the question?
Yes. So. And Mayor, Mr. Rodman, or Councilmember Rodman, so at the top of it, if you look at Attachment A, which is our general fund, we say budget completion through November is 41.7% on a straight line basis. Mm-hmm. And then our sales tax collections are 42%. So on a straight line basis, it would appear that we're going to come in right at budget. Mm-hmm. But behind the scenes, with all the details we have, we know December and January are significantly greater. Mm-hmm. And so we do make those projections to come up to the year end. We just don't give council all of that, right, that detail of how we project that.
Understood. Kind of, that was my point. Thank you.
Okay, Council Member Nicholson.
Budget and Finance Commission last night, there were some questions from the commissioners, and one of the ones that I really have been interested in, too, is the unfunded liabilities versus the booked liabilities concerning, like, the PSPRS, how they, it's unfunded liability, but it's not necessarily a bond that we have out there. Yet bond rating agencies, they look at our our financial stability and what's our ability to bond, you know, let's say the PSPRS unfunded liability. Do they look at that as, all right, now you've put that bond out, now we're not going to issue any more bonds, or that takes away from our ability to do more bonds? And as far as just unfunded liabilities, they look at that as a debt that we'll have to pay off eventually, which it is, but I don't know if bond rating agencies look that way. Is there any way that we can get a bond rating agency spokesperson to come talk to us, or the commission, or anyone?
Mayor, Councilmember Nicholson, the unfunded liability is in the financial statements. So that the $24 million, well, for this fiscal year, for the PSPRS is included in the financial statements. So the bond rating agencies do see that number. Just like they see any outstanding debt that we have in bonds. So I do believe that the rating agencies take that into consideration when they make their ratings analysis for the different towns. You know, so it is included in their analysis. To directly answer your question whether we could get someone to come out here, I haven't seen a rating analyst come out to a community. Typically, when we're issuing bonds, we go to them. But I mean, it's something that we could inquire if they do that. But I have not heard of that.
Councilmember Solomon,
what is the town's current bond rating?
Our Mr. Mayor and Councilmember Solomon, our current bond rating for our excise tax revenues is AA+. It was upgraded from AA- probably 6 to 8 months ago.
So we have an outstanding bond rating, and it's actually improved. So there is, or has not been, if there was an issue with this, our bond rating certainly wouldn't have improved. I just wanted people to be aware that town has a fantastic bond rating at AA+.
Yes, a AA+ bond rating is the second highest rating you can have. So it would be AAA, and then from AAA it goes down to a AA+. So we would be one notch below the highest bond rating that is available.
And once again, I mean, I'd like to thank staff and prior staff. It's pretty amazing that we're in that situation with such an incredible bond rating. So thanks.
Councilmember Pena.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Arts, in addition to the debt that the town has on its books, doesn't a bonding company look at other elements in that bond rating? It's not just specifically debt. They look at reserves. They look at other assets.
Yes. Mayor, Councilmember Pena, there are many factors that they look at. They look at your outstanding debt, your outstanding liabilities. As you mentioned, any reserves that the town or the city would have. They look at coverage. So we're pledging excise tax revenues to our debt. So they look at how many times coverage of the debt service that we have in excise tax collections. They look at median income of the community. So they look at the wealth levels in the community. So where I came from in Avondale, we always had a challenge getting the bond rating up higher because they always looked at the median income levels. And so that plays a big factor to them. So there are many, many factors, not just the amount of debt that you have outstanding that plays into the ratings analysis.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your questions, comments, counsel. Mr. Arts, we appreciate your presentation and responding to questions. The next item on the agenda is the consent agenda. To entertain a motion.
Mr. Mayor, I move to approve the consent agenda items A through C.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes 7-0. There's no items on the regular agenda. Any future agenda items, Council?
Mr. Mayor.
Vice Mayor Barrett?
I just have two things that are fairly simple that I'd like to potentially add to an agenda so we could have a brief discussion about. And one is with the timing of commission meetings relative to council meetings, if there needs to be any buffer between the commission meetings and the council meetings or not. And then the second is a discussion of some of the things that we could potentially put on the website routinely. And so I guess the question would be, what action could council take relative to those items? So I'd like to have on the agenda discussion and possible action, just a simple thing.
Okay. That was captured. Any other additional agenda items?
No.
Okay, hearing none, we'll adjourn the regular session and we'll go into study session. We can have a brief recess. Should we have a break?
Yes.
Okay. Let's see. How about is 6 minutes? I'm just looking at my. So how about we'll resume at 7:40? And I'm glad I brought a chuckle to you, Christy. Precision. All right. Well, we'd like to call this study session to order. Mr. Standish. Oh, we don't take roll call.
Yep.
All right. So the first item.
Discussion regarding the state-imposed expenditure limitation and options for alternative expenditure limitations, including the permanent base adjustment option.
Okay. Manager Jacobs.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of council. I'm just going to briefly introduce the subject and then turn this over to Mr. Arts for the presentation. As you know, the town is required to follow state law when it comes to what is referred to as the alternative expenditure limitation. And basically, you all have been here through an election. We just had one a year and a half ago, which requires the town to go out to the voters every 4 years in order to actually spend the dollars that we collect. We do have another option. In fact, we have a couple of other options, but there really is one in particular that that is going to be recommended for council consideration. It does require voter approval, but tonight we thought we would start with a study session so we can simply share the information with you, make sure that you don't have any questions. I do want to mention that several months ago, I did specifically task the Budget and Finance Commission with reviewing my recommendation on this, and last night they did vote to recommend to town council that you move forward with placing this item on the ballot, and we'll go over that in just a little bit. So with that, Mr. Mayor, I'll turn it over to Mr. Arts. Thank you.
Mr. Arts, you're the man of the evening.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. So good evening, Mayor and Council. Staff is here tonight to discuss the options for the expenditure limitation, for the alternative expenditure limitation. And just to give some background on what the state-imposed expenditure limitation is, the Arizona Constitution and Arizona Revised Statute impose an expenditure limitation on every city and town in the state. And what they did is they took a baseline of expenditures from your budget in 1979, 1980. So whatever your budget was in that year, that was your base. So in 1979-80, the town of Oro Valley had a budget of $272,317, primarily a residential community with little to no economic base at the time. So from that number, the State Economic Estimates Commission adjusts the limitation each year, and they adjust it for a standard inflation rate. So every city and town gets an adjustment for the same amount, and then they do a population growth factor. And so the town of Oro Valley's population has grown from 1,475 in 1979-80 to 45,184. So the State Economic Estimates Commission takes that number, the $272,000, applies the inflation growth and the population growth, and that gives us a fiscal year 1920 expenditure limitation of $25.7 million. So that's what the state tells the town of Oro Valley that we are able to spend without one of the alternative options. So again, the calculation on the numbers, so the $272,000 is the base from 79-80. The inflation adjustment is 3.0822, and then our population adjustment is 30.6332. So you take the $272,000, multiply it times the 3.08, multiply it times the 30.63, and that's how the state calculates our state imposed limit of $25.7 million. So the state does also allow cities and towns to exclude expenditures from certain revenue sources from your expenditure limitation. Some of those revenue sources are bond proceeds. So any expenditures out of bond proceeds do not go against your expenditure limitation. Any interest income that's received does not go against the expenditure limitation of the town. And then any federal grants you get or any intergovernmental revenues that you get from another Arizona entity, so for example from the state, and those revenues would be subject to that other entity's expenditure limitation. So if you get an intergovernmental agreement and you get revenue and they're reporting the expenditures under their state imposed limitation, you don't have to report that. So it's a bit of work to go through and determine what all of those revenue exclusions are when you do the expenditure limitation. So staff estimates that exclusions for this year would total $14.3 million. So we would have expenditures of $14.3 million from interest income grants, intergovernmental revenues, and any bond proceeds that we may have. So what that means is you take that $25 million state imposed limitation, you add the $14 million to it. So for 2019-20, we would have a $40 million expenditure limitation for the town of Oro Valley. Our budget for this year is $111 million. So we would be $61 million over our expenditure limitation if we weren't on home rule. So that's important to note that we're on home rule. We're on home rule through 2022-23. And so we have already adopted one of the alternatives, so we're not living under this state-imposed limitation of $40.1 million. But if the voters did not approve the home rule or the permanent base adjustment, that would be our limitation, and we would have to take a very difficult look at our budget going forward. So why doesn't the state imposed limitation work in Oro Valley? To sum it up, it's really, as I mentioned earlier, in 1980, we're a very small community, residential community, with little to no economic base. And we've grown our economic base since that time, but those state adjustments don't account for retail growth. They look at inflationary growth and population growth, but it doesn't look at the fact that we had very little retail in 1980, and now we've become a bit of a regional shopping destination, not only for our own residents, but residents of the county and other unincorporated areas that come to our town to shop and pay those sales tax revenues. Also, the 79-80 budget provided sufficient service levels at that time, but residents today are demanding more services than they were back in 1980. So parks and recreation is a much bigger issue today than it was then, and our residents are demanding those services. Also, we didn't have a water utility back in 1980. So we acquired that sometime in the 90s, and our water utility itself is about a $22 million budget. So that water utility that we're spending $22 million on currently was never factored into the base because we didn't have a water utility back in 1980. That doesn't account for new revenue sources that we have. So back in 1980, we didn't have impact fees, and now we charge impact fees that go to help fund infrastructure needs as a result of new growth. Those additional water revenues that I mentioned earlier that we receive now that we didn't have in 1980. And then any increases in the sales tax rates that have occurred since then. And then it also doesn't account for the increases in the commercial activity. The growth factor, again, it covers population and average inflation, but it doesn't account for the town of Oro Valley becoming a regional retail shopping area and drawing some of those sales tax revenues in from non-residents. So the state provided four options. So if the state imposed limitation didn't work for a community, they did have the foresight to include four different options. The first option is the home rule option. The town of Oro Valley's been on this since 1980, so almost 40 years we've been a home rule community. And what a home rule community means is your expenditure limitation is set at your adopted budget. So whatever you budget in that given year, that's your expenditure limitation. The home rule option must be approved by the voters, and it does require approval every 4 years. And so that is one of the factors on why we're recommending to go to the permanent base adjustment. You have some additional cost of doing an election every 4 years, the staff time of preparing for that election. And so those are some of the factors that the permanent base adjustment looks like an attractive alternative to staff. So the permanent base adjustment, it goes back and modifies that base number of $272,000, and it's a permanent adjustment. So it's a one-time approval by the voters. It's a reduction of election cost and staff time every 4 years, and it provides stability to service levels. Because once you have that in place, you don't have to have the concern about what's going to happen at that next home rule election. It's a permanent increase. Now, you can go back and do an additional increase. So if you do a permanent base adjustment and in 20 years that is determined not to be enough for your budget at that time, you can go back and adjust your base again. So it's not a one-time shot at it, but once you have it, it's in place until you, if you need to adjust it again in the future. The other two options are a capital projects fund and a one-time override. These are really useful in instances where the state imposed limitations adequate for your operating costs, but you have some capital needs. That really does not apply to us. So in our view, the capital projects and the one-time override options are not an option for Oro Valley at this time. So as the town manager mentioned, the town manager did request the Budget and Finance Commission to review the state imposed expenditure limitation and make a recommendation to council. So staff has presented the expenditure limitation to the Budget and Finance Commission, at the November, December, and January meetings. We did the same thing. We went through a background with them, gave them some history of it and why it doesn't work for the town of Oro Valley. Last night at the Budget and Finance Commission meeting, the commission did recommend forwarding the permanent base adjustment option to council for your consideration, and that is consistent with staff's recommendation. And the BFC also recommended to adjust that base up to $1.65 million. And again, that's consistent with staff's recommendation. Staff had initially proposed a minimum of 1.4, and then the commission asked for a range, and we gave them a range of 1.4 to 1.8. And last night they settled on the $1.65 million as the adjusted base. And again, apologize for the size of this, but what this shows here is staff put in the $1.65 million as our base. That would give us a $162 million expenditure limitation for fiscal year 2021. Staff estimated a budget of $114 million, so we would be having capacity of about $47 million under our expenditure limitation. And then we also calculated a net capacity, and that stays consistent over a 20-year period. And that was something that was important to staff, is making sure that we get a number that will last for at least 20 years. And so we do feel comfortable that at the commission's recommendation of $1.65 million that it would provide enough capacity for the town over a 20-year period. And so the way it works...
Councilmember Rodman has a question.
I'm sorry. Part of it's my eyesight. Can you tell me toward the end, are we still significantly under the expenditure limitation? And if so, I'm sorry, I just can't read it from here.
Mr. Mayor and Councilmember Rodman, yes. Actually, it increases over time, but it's the percentage of capacity is staying approximately the same. So it starts off at 42% capacity, ends at 40%, but our additional capacity in dollars is $83 million by fiscal year 39-40.
Okay, you want to wait until he's done, until we talk? I'm just trying to understand. Again, we're going to certainly educate and talk with our community, because there will be an election. I'm just trying to understand. It seems like it's a lot of excess expenditure being considered to be approved. I am a citizen, so if I took this hat off, I'd be saying, why do we need to do this increase to give you $80 million more than you think we're going to need?
Mr. Mayor, Councilmember Rodman, it's hard to predict 20 years in the future. And so having excess capacity can, if the council of 15 years from now were to decide to, purchase another utility or do something that is outside of what we can imagine or visualize at this point, there won't be a need to go back to the voters. And so, the difference that the community sees is, again, as Mr. Arts and I discussed, the minimum that we felt needed to be adjusted is $1.4 million. So it's a difference of $250,000, which is really not that much. And our job is going to be, how do we communicate this simply to the residents? Because we won't be showing this table. This is not a table that, we'll have it in a hip pocket, but what we would plan on doing if the council moves forward with this, with an election, is putting an education program together that really is very similar to what we did with Home Rule, except that we focus on why is this a little bit of a change, and because the ballot language will obviously be different.
Well, so maybe the follow-up question is, you did all of your analysis and came up with 1.4. If I remember hearing it right last night as we were going, one of the reasons, or maybe the only reason that I heard to go up to 1.65, was to provide some capacity to pay off the unfunded liability. that other $23 or $24 million, and you guys did the math and said, well, that would be 1.65. You guys went with 1.4. I'd like to hear why you thought that was the one you wanted to recommend last night. I get it that the commission was tasked to do its own analyzation and make a recommendation, but I don't know that we've decided to put that number here. And I'd like to see the 1.4 and why you guys thought that was sufficient for the 20-year time period, as opposed to going right to 1.6. Obviously, we need to make the decision. Thank you.
Certainly.
So Councilmember Pena had a question. I don't know, Mr. Arts, I don't know how much of your presentation remains. Is it
Mr. Mayor, there's really only a calendar left. So
I can wait. It's fine. Okay. Yeah, I'll wait.
So if we were to go to the $1.65 million as the base adjustment, you would again apply those the inflation factor, that population adjustment, and that would give us a state-imposed limitation for the current fiscal year of approximately $155 million. And again, our current budget is $111 million, so it would give us approximately 40% capacity if that was in place for this fiscal year. And as far as the calendar, so we had this council study session tonight. The plan is to bring back a resolution for council consideration on March 4th. If council approves that resolution, then staff would be preparing the detailed analysis and the publicity pamphlet in the March to April timeframe, printing of the publicity pamphlet in June, and then the primary election is August 4th. So that would be the time frame. So the critical deadline or time frame for us is that March 4th resolution consideration. That's what gets us started on it and gets us where we need to be in time for the election if this is something that council wants to move forward with.
And if I may just add, I know that we explained it to the Budget and Finance Commission, but the reason why this is being brought to you in this year is because we're in the middle of what would otherwise be our required four-year cycle. So, and what that does is gives us a little cushion just in case, you know, we're not successful in explaining this to our voters, although I believe that if we can explain home rule, I think we can probably do a good job with this. But just in case, if we were to do it on the four-year cycle, it's an either or, and so then we would, and it didn't pass, we wouldn't have that. We'd have to go back to, you know, our actual expenditure limitation. So so if this is not the year that you feel comfortable moving it forward, mm-hmm. then it would come back to you, my recommendation, in four more years. So we wouldn't want to, you know, muddy the waters. We would want to continue to do what we've been successful with in 2022 for our regular home rule. But if this is successful this year, then we won't have to have any future elections until if we were somehow to exceed our expenditure limitation. One of the other things, I think, again, just for those of you who did not see the presentations to the Budget and Finance Commission, Mr. Arts reviewed the expenditure limitations for communities. I think about over half of the communities have the permanent base.
Yes.
Yeah, so over half of the communities in Arizona also have the permanent base, and most of them are well over their budgets, depending on, of course, when they were approved by the voters and that sort of thing. In fact, I believe it's Surprise who's at an expenditure limitation that they will never get in the billions of of dollars. So really this is, you know, we can go with whatever the number is that council's comfortable. Staff is comfortable. We felt a minimum of 1.4, minimum, and up to 1.8. So that really was where we felt we could go. And again, it's part crystal ball, it's part projection, it's part making sure that we have a cushion. So you know, the difference in terms of communicating with residents, the ballot language will be shall the town of Oro Valley have an expenditure-based limitation that is increased by blah, you know, whatever the difference is. It, you know, $100,000 or $150,000 or $200,000 is not going to make that much of a difference in terms of our communications efforts. But we can certainly go along with the, you know, provided we're in that window, staff can support the council's decision on this matter.
Councilmember Pena.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Arts, what's the cost of doing the expenditure when we put it on the ballot, the alternative expenditure measure, when it goes on? What does that cost the town every 4 years?
Mayor, Councilmember Pena, it was estimated that it's $15,000 of cash outlay, okay, but then just the additional staff time of preparing for it every 4 years also.
Okay, and then just, I just want to make sure I understand. So the 1.4 to the 1.6, how was that derived? Was it just a forecast of what our expenditures would be, including looking at, did finance and budget look at a PSPRS additional payment that goes into that? Tell me how that was calculated, or how did we get to that number?
So originally, when staff brought this forward, we brought forward a recommendation of $1.4 million. And then at the second commission meeting, the commissioners asked us to come back with a range that we would be comfortable with. So at the meeting last night, we proposed a range between the $1.4 and the $1.8 million. There was a commissioner that brought up the point that if a future council wanted to pay off the entire unfunded liability of the pension in a given year, that it would be nice to have that extra capacity. So they wanted to see what an additional $24 million basically of additional capacity would be. And so staff had prepared a model where I could change the numbers on the fly, and we changed it from 1.4 to 1.65. That got the commissioner to where they wanted to be. So that's how they settled on the $1.65 million last night.
Okay, so that's on a 20-year table or timeline, if you will. So is that $24 million that you're talking about on a 20-year, like an amortization, if you will? Is that the way it was laid out?
No. So Mayor, Councilmember Pena, it was just assumed that the $24 million would be paid in 1 year.
Okay.
And so it is increasing your expenditure limit for each of the 20 years,
right,
when
okay,
that $24 million payment would only be made in one of those years.
Okay, that's what I was trying to understand. And then, and the reason, and this may have nothing to do with one or the other, but you can instruct us on this. So when we look at our forecasting, right, you've provided, because we're going to get into the budget season, we're going to look at forecasting, and our last forecast look at 5 years, and then we do a 10-year capital improvement forecast. So I guess my question is, if this is going out to 20 years, but typically we look at a 5-year forecast or 10-year projections on the debt, right, going forward, how does that factor into what's going on with the 20-year?
Mayor, Councilmember,
looking 20 years out versus 5 and 10.
So, Mayor, Councilmember Pena, that when staff prepared the analysis for the permanent base adjustment, what I did is I went back and looked at the past 10 years and what our budget grew over that 10-year period. So I had a historical actual of our budget over a 10-year period. Then I simply took that percentage increase over the next 20-year period.
Okay.
So it was not using, Wendy's 5-year forecast. It was just simply taking what our growth rate was over a 10-year period and projecting that over a 20-year period.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
And if I may just add very quickly, as you recall, the budget in the current fiscal year is significantly lower than it was last year. And the reason why is because we have now not budgeted the totality of the town's reserves in the budgets, which is a best practice, as we talked about in the budget process last year. However, if there were to be a time when, and again, we're crystal balling here, where the council saved up enough money in a reserve and decided to make a one lump payment towards something big, then we would need some capacity in order to do right. that. And so we want to make sure that it's that careful balance. Or if a future council were to decide to rebudget all of the reserves again, you know, we would want to make sure that there's, it's certainly not something that I recommend. It's not something that Kevin recommends, but again, it's about providing some flexibility for the councils and managers of the future.
So given that, I mean, there's a number of towns that have this practice in place, what, if any, are the unintended consequences or negative impacts that would come from the council moving forward with a permanent expenditure?
Yeah, Mayor, Councilor Pena, I can't think of any negative consequences of doing a permanent base adjustment and having it passed.
Okay. Great, thank you.
Vice Mayor Barrett.
Thank you. Thanks for the presentation, and thanks for the three times the Budget and Finance Commission heard this. I think if anyone has any questions, listening to those is really insightful for digging a little bit deeper, and the staff had great answers. So I won't repeat those, but I think that this boils down into questions in two different sections, and by mixing them together, I find it to be a little bit confusing. And so to me, the first question is, should we move towards a permanent base adjustment and approve that for this ballot? And then the second question would be, and if so, how much should that be? And so when we kind of talk about both of them at the same time, I feel like that can be a little bit confusing. So in focusing on the should we, I have to say that I was surprised in the packet when it said that it wouldn't provide us with any cost savings because we would have additional reporting requirements, which would then offset the staff time for and the election costs for doing the home rule adjustment over time. And so can you detail that a little bit more? Because in my mind, when this was first presented to me, I felt that one of the main advantages would be that we wouldn't have to spend the staff time and the money for the ballot to go every 4 years to an election.
And Mayor, Vice Mayor Barrett, what I was trying to get at that is that there is significant staff time every 4 years to prepare for the home rule election. But if you go to a permanent base adjustment, it does change the reporting requirements. And so under home rule, it's a very simple report. Basically, your budget's $111 million, you spent 80, you're under your expenditure limitation. When you go to a permanent base adjustment, then you have to start factoring in all of those revenue exclusions. You have to, there's just significantly more staff time to prepare the report versus a home rule report. But I still believe it makes sense, even though the staff time, there may not be a savings by going to a permanent base adjustment. You will recognize savings from not having to do an election every 4 years, so you will save that $15,000 out of pocket. But I do believe that the staff time just gets reallocated from doing an election every 4 years to spending more time every year preparing the report.
And if I may, Mr. Mayor, Vice Mayor Barrett, one of the things that I think is very hard to measure is the amount of political capital that it takes every year to unconfuse a citizenry about something. People, you know, we get a lot of people who move here. We have to go through the same process every year. And if there is an alternative to fixing this for some period of time, then I think it gives us the opportunity to focus on those things and ballot measures that are really more meaningful than perfunctory. Because for a perfunctory ballot measure, we spend a lot of time reaching out, educating our community, and people still, I mean, we're very fortunate in that people pass it, but I think this is a case of, is there a better way? And from our perspective, we believe that this is a better way.
Okay. I guess I was just commenting on the fact that I felt that one of the advantages would be a cost savings, but it seems like the revenue stability is really the primary advantage rather than the cost savings. But so that kind of gets to my second question in the should we do this or not. You mentioned the political capital that is spent by going out for the home rule every 4 years, and I can certainly understand that. The four of us who were recently elected ran at the same time as the home rule, and we got a lot of questions from residents about what the home rule was, where we stood on that issue, and so it definitely kind of tagged along as an election issue. So I can understand that. But at the same time, I think there's also some concern that I have about, one, political capital being used up to do this, if there are other important things that may be going to the electorate in the pending future. And then, two, that the most valuable thing is our time. And we have an entire general plan full of priorities that our citizens have voted on that they'd like to see accomplished. And we're always prioritizing those. Where do those fall? And so the question to me is this something that we want to prioritize our time on in this fiscal year, as well as our finances, in this fiscal year and in the following fiscal year, versus continuing the home rule in the future? And what I'd like to know is, you know, what priorities will not be done because this is something that we're moving forward with, particularly if there's anything in the strategic leadership plan and, you know, the priorities in the general plan. Like, how much staff time will this take? What kind of alternative things could be done with that staff time in this fiscal year and next fiscal year? So those are two questions that I'd like to see addressed, maybe just before we hear this again. And then on the question of if we do move forward with it, how much we should do, I'm inclined to agree with Council Member Rodman. I think that one thing I found with the home rule was that explaining it to people, there were a lot of people who in our community who felt that they would like to vote against any government spending increases at all, and that that was sort of just a policy of theirs, that they would vote against those. And that's probably the 30-35% who vote against the home rule fall into that category. And so I do feel like if we overreach with the amount, that we run the risk of not seeming reasonable and then putting the significant amount of time, effort, political capital into it only to fail. So to me, it would be important if we were to move forward with it that we were somewhat conservative in our approach so that we could assure voters that this does not mean a dramatic increase in government spending, that it would be simply a procedural sort of thing to replace the home rule that they normally vote on. So those are kind of my feelings on that issue, as Councilmember Rodman had mentioned those questions.
Did you want to
speak to?
Okay, all right.
Mr. Mayor, Vice Mayor Barrett, we'll be happy to provide information. What I can tell you is that I don't foresee any need to hold on any of the council strategic objectives as a result of this. So it's something that the staff already builds into its staff time every 4 years. We have it down. We would have to change our messaging a bit, but I believe that we kind of have the formula. We just did it, and so we have that formula down. It's a winning formula, and so I wouldn't anticipate any loss of responding to council's requests in other areas.
Okay, Vice Mayor Barron.
Okay, sorry, I just wanted to quickly follow up with that. So since that's something that we kind of budget for and do with our staff time every 4 years, what would be the impact to this fiscal year's budget and next fiscal year's budget?
Mr. Mayor, Vice Mayor Barrett, in terms of the dollar impact would not occur until next fiscal year because the election doesn't occur until next fiscal year. So we would include it in the budget from a dollar perspective. And then the, you know, the staff time is, there's always pulls on staff time in terms of what are the priorities, and council priorities always come first. And so, you know, if this ends up being something that the council wants to move forward, then, you know, we look at what are those other things, where do we squeeze in the time. The more advanced notice we have, the more time that we have to prepare. So, you know, the calendar that Mr. Arts has up there, the March 4th is the outset at which that would be the last date by which the council could move this forward and us have enough time to get all of the required things in place between notifying the Pima County to put it on the ballot and the publicity pamphlet and that kind of thing. This is also something that we could have on your agenda in February as well, so that we would have that much more time in order to get ahead of the game.
Councilmember Rodman.
Yeah, a couple of points. One of the things you said that was talking about, we'll have the extra money there because if we do have some major expense that we haven't had to have before or aren't anticipating, we'd have the expenditure limit high enough to do it. My default position is if it's that big, I'd just assume that we talk about it, and that just assume that we maybe need even more public input about if we're going to decide to spend $24 million on something that we hadn't planned necessarily. So I don't think the idea of having to have that excess capacity that we haven't decided we need when we go to them. I mean, to me, it's a credibility issue. I like the idea of the permanent-based adjustment. Don't get me wrong. I like that a lot. I think it makes sense. This formula they have that they make us do is silly. I mean, we still deal with it every 4 years and have to explain why we have to do that. But at least we only do that once. But I don't think I would not feel comfortable overreaching. When somebody says to me, well, wait a minute, you have $80 million you don't need? Why are you doing that again? Now, if they listen to me long enough, maybe they'll say okay. But if they're on the way out of the supermarket line, then maybe not, because their ice cream is melting. You know, so that piece of it that worries me, that we don't really need it. If we decide to spend $24 million or whatever the number turns out to be on the unfunded liability, then I think we ought to talk about that and decide it separately on that and plan for it in a particular budget year. Obviously, we're talking about, you know, it's a little bit misleading. We're talking as though if we were to do this 1.65, that somehow we'd spend it. Well, we still have to have the revenues in order to do that. So clearly in a budget process, it does have public. But I just don't want to see us overreach. So I'll come back to my first question. Originally, as you said, Kevin, the first one was 1.4. Then the commission asked for a range. So you felt comfortable with 1.4. So what changed, or why were you comfortable with 1.4? Help me understand, you know, why, what your original, were you concerned about 1.4, that it wasn't enough? In other words, how do we get from there, besides the fact that the commission recommended it, from the staff perspective?
Mr. Mayor and Councilmember Rodman, staff had some of the very same concerns that you did. We wanted to present a conservative number, and the 1.4 generally got us about 20% capacity over what we were projecting the budget. And I initially felt comfortable with the projections that 20% capacity would be adequate. As we got into the discussions with the commission, there was a lot of what ifs. Well, what if we do this? What if we do that project? And so there just seemed to be some, well, they asked us to come back with a range. And so we did with that $1.4 to $1.8 million. But as the town manager and I discussed it initially, we were comfortable with 1.4, and I still believe that number would provide adequate capacity for the town over a 20-year period.
Thank you.
Councilmember Nicholson.
Okay. Just curious, I know Steve and Bill alluded to the pension being paid off, $25 million, that they could do that in 1 year. I'm kind of curious, like, how would why, how is that number factored into paying a pension off the $24 million? First of all, like you said, like you'd have to have the revenue of the $24 million to put it in there. So right now our budgeted revenue is about $80 million, but we're capped at $110 million-ish for home rule. That's correct. So we got like a $30 million buffer right now. And this is raising it from 30 up to about $40 million right now and possibly up to $80 million in 20 years.
If we were to use the 1.65, then yes, it increases that excess capacity up to $80 million over it by the year 20. The 1.4 adjustment, I don't have those numbers here in front of me, but I you know, I'm sorry? 38 million at the end of the 20 years. And that was, again, approximately 20% capacity. And that's what I was looking at, trying to maintain some flexibility there. And staff felt comfortable with the 20% number.
Okay. But if it did a bond, either PSPRS or any other type of bond, you don't take the whole $20 million of the bond. It's the payment, correct? So, like, our catch-up fund of PSPRS is $1.9 million. A 2% bond for 20 years for $24 million, that's $1.39 million a year. So that would reduce our budget by $500,000, or budget expenditures by $500,000 a year. So that wouldn't count as a $25 million increase to our budget. It just...
Well, I believe, Mr. Mayor and Councilmember Nicholson, what the concept was at the commission meeting was that we would take $25 million and make a one-time payment, having the flexibility to do that. So to your point, if we issued bonds to do that, then that actually would fall under one of the exclusions, that those are expenditures coming from bond proceeds, so we wouldn't need it. Okay. But if we were to take, you know, at some point in the future, if we had $25 million in fund balance and a future council wanted to make a lump sum payment, I believe that's what the commissioner was trying to get at.
Or if we had like $30 million in the general fund bond and they want to do an Naranja Park bond, but they don't want to do that. They just want to spend it all year. If we had that general fund money, they can just spend that money for it. So that's my one concern too, is if you have a certain amount of budget availability, at some point some year you could just spend that money with your reserves or something to that effect, correct? That's kind of one of my concerns, because obviously our state, you know, is trying to sell state capital when they're down in the doldrums, and I worry about people at Oro Valley in the future councils where they spend too much money on something, and, you know, because they have that budget leniency at some point in time. But
and again, as the point was made earlier by one of the council members, that any of the alternative expenditure limitations don't increase your revenues or your ability to tax. It just allows you to spend what you're currently collecting.
Councilmember Jones Ivy.
Yes, Kevin. Thank you for the information. And if we could go back to the previous slide where you had projected out, I think it was for 40. It was the that one right there. Okay. So, in looking at those figures for every year, what would the percentage increase be?
Mayor, Councilmember, the what we're projecting on this slide is what the additional capacity would be. Mm-hmm. So what I mean by that is what the capacity are. So for year one, projecting that the expenditure limitation would be $162 million. Are projecting a total budget of $114 million. So there would be $47 million. We would be $47 million below our state imposed expenditure limitation, based on those numbers.
So this just gives us the capacity to spend more if we need to spend more. Yes. Is that what I'm hearing?
It gives us capacity under the state imposed expenditure limitation, mm-hmm. but it does not give us the authority to spend more money. That we, if we don't have it, we can't spend it. This doesn't change that.
Okay. So for where we are now with home rule and what our projected budget is, can we not at some point make the decision that we're going to pay off our unfunded liability without having a permanent based adjustment? And just home rule every 4 years with the voters voting on that?
Yes, Mr. Mayor and Council Member, the unfunded liability isn't driving this discussion at all. It kind of came up as a tangent when we were discussing it with the commission. This item is completely separate from our pension liability. Staff believes that this provides some stability to the town going forward of only having to do the election one time instead of having to do it every 4 years.
Okay. Thank you.
Council Member Solomon.
Just to first clarify, under current home rule, my understanding is basically we can send whatever our budget is that we set. So if we decided to set our budget $25 million above this coming budget, $25 million above what our current year budget was, we can do that. So there's no limitation on if for some reason we wanted to, quote, pay off something. Additionally, on this program, if we had a lower excess capacity, you could always pay it off in 2 years instead of 1 year. So you don't have to have it built in. But my main concern is right now, every 4 years, we have to go to the voters and, as you said, try to explain to them really an administrative function. What is the consequence if we fail in doing that 1 year and they do not approve home rule? And our $130 million budget drops to $25 million. So what actually happens?
Mr. Mayor, Councilmember Solomon, what happens is the town is required to we are required to meet the expenditure limitation. So we could perhaps for a year get a little creative, issue bonds for our capital, you know, in order to exempt that. But we don't spend a lot of capital every year anyway. But ultimately, what it would mean is we would need to make significant cuts in 1 year, and there have been communities where that has happened. And so, you know, what we are trying to avoid is, you know, that potential in the future. Again, we don't have we don't have a crystal ball. And so, but it would be a significant, and it's in the general fund for the most part, but really it's the overall total. That's where most of our services are provided, and so it would be a big hit to our service levels.
Basically, it would be the end of the town as we know it. That there's no way that we could cut our spending that dramatically without major layoffs and cutbacks in services, and then how long is it before you can go back to the voters again? Can you go the next year, or do you have to wait?
2 years.
2 years. So basically, the town will be decimated. In 2 years, all the people that are left are not coming back. If the community goes, oh my gosh, there's no parks, there's no police, there's no road maintenance, we've lost everything that we've wanted in this community because we misunderstood or people gave us misinformation, that's the end of the community. So to me, that's the key here. I don't like the way this is so overinflated. I think it's ridiculous, and that does concern me. But I think the key issue is every 4 years, this community is at 100% at risk over a technicality. It's not going to the voters and saying, wow, here's one direction of the town where you got to increase taxes and spending. Here's another direction you don't. This is administrative. This is due to something the state legislature passed to control local municipalities because they don't treat us as adults. And it's happened to other communities. So that's something we got to seriously consider, because if it happens, the community is over with. And is that a significant enough risk for us to say, why do we do that every 4 years as opposed to this? Or maybe we want to. Maybe we want to say, hey, that's fine. If the community wants to dissolve itself by doing this, the community can basically dissolve itself by doing this.
Mr. Mayor, just a couple questions. So if the council were to adopt this permanent solution, then let's just say we
decided we wanted to have a large one-time expenditure. It still has to be approved by council, separate from this table and how it's laid out, correct? Okay.
Yes, correct.
Okay. Now, if there were a situation where there was concern about the amount of expenditures, what happens with removing or rescinding or changing the adoption of this permanent expenditure policy? What would that look like?
Mr. Mayor, Councilmember Pena, what if the council is interested in moving this forward, you are not adopting the permanent base adjustment. You are voting to place it on a ballot. And so the voters then would have the opportunity, in order to change it again, up or down, it would have to go back to the voters in order to make that change.
Kevin, at the Budget and Finance Commission meeting, you had the ability to insert. Do we have that ability this evening? It might help council to see. If we don't, we don't. But.
Mr. Mayor, I don't have it up, but if we can get to a shared drive, I would be able to bring up the model.
Is that of interest to the council? To
it is see? To me, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, if we could. Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. And what do you recall, Ms. Jacobs? What was the percentage that Home Rule passed in 2018? I mean, it wasn't a nail biter, is my recollection.
It's not a nail biter.
Mr. Mayor, I was just looking at those numbers earlier today, and in 2018, the Home Rule passed with 9,100, just over 9,100 votes yes, and just over 4,500 votes no. So, okay.
About 75%.
Yeah. So a strong
showing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 2-1.
And just out of curiosity, while there, what happens if we exceed the state limitation?
Mr. Mayor, I'll be honest with you. I don't think any finance director or town manager worth their salt would bring forward to you a budget that exceeded the state expenditure limitation.
I understand. This is more
purely hypothetical.
Yeah, hypothetical. If somehow this was imposed.
We'd probably get our hands slapped. The State Department of Revenue, you know, might come down and say, you know, you went over your expenditure limitation. You can't do that. And then it would be fixed the next year, would be my guess.
Well,
so,
could a resident file a lawsuit if we're violating state law?
I don't know what the cure would be, other than if someone found it mid-year and we found out that we were, I don't know, $1 million over our limit, we could voluntarily go back, cut the budget, make sure that we didn't spend over it.
Yeah, I was thinking more in terms of if this was imposed on the community, it was around $40 million. Our budget was $111. That's a $71 million, you know, that it would exceed that limitation, right? That would not be looked upon.
In terms of if we don't hit the expenditure
limit? Well, if Home Rule was not passed.
Oh,
okay.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. Didn't City of Tucson, weren't they in this?
No.
No? Okay.
Florence, the town of Florence, had this situation. And actually, Chris was just looking up something. Apparently, they did go back the next year and do one of those one-year overrides. They had to do that every year until they were able to get their home rule passed again. So it, you know, is it possible we could kind of scooch by for a year? Yeah, it is, but it would be a lot of effort. We don't want to go there for sure. Yeah, we definitely.
Mr. Mayor, so this is the model. So I have changed it to the $1.4 million. And so this would show in fiscal year 2021
the capacity of approximately $23 million or a 20% percentage of capacity.
And this is what you originally proposed?
Yes, Mayor, that's correct.
And your comfort level with this, is it significantly changed after these discussions with the Budget and Finance Commission?
No, I still believe as a minimum the 1.4 would be an appropriate minimum amount. You know, with the Budget and Finance Commission wanting some additional flexibility, it was still within the range of being reasonable, but this was staff's initial recommendation.
Vice Mayor Barron.
Thank you. So let's talk about what this would actually look like to our voters of these two different amounts, or a lower an amount or a higher amount. You mentioned that what the ballot would say. So the ballot will only have a $125,000 difference on it, or let's see. Is that how much we're talking about?
So,
$250,000?
Yeah, so Mayor and Vice Mayor Barrett, basically the ballot language, our current base limit is $272,000. So if we wanted to go to a base limit of 1.4, the ballot language is, do you want to increase your base limit by the difference of those two? So it would be $1.15 million or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So that would get you to the 1.4. To go to the 1.65, it would be, do you want to increase your base limit by $1.35 million?
So it's not likely that based on what would be written on the ballot that that amount differential would really cause a huge difference in the amount of voters who would vote for or against, in your opinion.
In my opinion, I think that's correct, because they're not going to see this analysis. They're going to see a proposal in front of them. Do you increase the base amount by $1.1 million or $1.3 million? So there may not be as significant of an impact when they're looking at it on the ballot.
Okay. And what would our approach be to try and make sure that every voter would be as educated as possible as to what this means? Because, you know, I would think we'd want to educate them not just, yeah, let's do it, but also just what this means in practicality so they can understand.
Mr. Mayor, Vice Mayor Barrett, I'm actually going to let Misty Nowak answer this. She helped to develop a communication strategy for our last go-around, and while we obviously haven't quite tasked her with this yet because the council hasn't made a decision on it, I think we, like I said, we have a pretty good formula of outreach that I can have her just briefly go over.
Sure. Thank you, Mary. Mr. Mayor, Council. So similar to previous outreach efforts, this would be more complicated. There would be more information that we wanted to convey. And we've done that similarly with the Naranja Park bond election, for example. That was a lot of information to convey. And so we created collateral for the community to help explain the details of it, and then had put together some digital outreach, so social media, some paid digital advertising, and then we actually had groups that would go out and speak to and give presentations to help answer questions, and then presentations available online. So pretty much running the full gamut of our different outreach tools.
Okay, thanks. I guess what I'm trying to just tease out is, what difference would it make, would that number make to voters one way or the other? And so that is helpful. And we're fortunate that we have a very intelligent and educated electorate, but, you know, town finances are kind of difficult to comprehend all at one quick glance. So, yeah.
Councilmember Rodman.
Yeah, and your point's well taken in terms of the number on the ballot, but when you explain to them what it means, you're talking about $38 million versus $80 million. In capacity. So that's a big number. And you can't just say to people, it's only $200,000, $250,000, or whatever the number. It's only whatever it is, because you got to explain to them what it means. You know, what are we doing this for? Well, we need we want to make sure we have enough expenditure capacity. Well, okay, so what is it for? What does it go out to? Well, $38 million. Well, that's a lot. Well, how'd you like the other one? We're asking you for it's $80 million. Why do you need that? You know, I mean, that's the piece that I just want to make sure, and we've got time before we have to vote on it, that we just don't overreach if we don't need to. Hence my question about the 1.4 that you were comfortable with. Last night's discussion didn't tell me a real reason that I would vote for as to why we would want to do that extra amount. So thank you.
Councilmember Nicholson and then Councilmember Solomon.
It seems to me like changing from 1.4 to 1.6, like right now 1.4 changing from our home rule right now is, we don't have to do it every 4 years, but probably in 20 years we may have to do it. But if we did 1.65, then we may have to change it, and we probably have 40 years to do it. Have to change it via a vote, right? I mean, when it boils down to it, that's really what the, other than the perception is it goes from $30 million to $80 million, which I agree with Bill is a huge amount. But technically speaking, I mean, well, it allows us to go longer before we have to put it back on the ballot in some ways. Or
correct. So Mayor, Councilmember Nicholson, but even at the $1.4 million, it's in this analysis still showing that we would have additional capacity.
And even out,
and honestly, the reason for that is your base adjustment is growing by an inflationary rate and population, and I'm growing the budget by an inflationary rate. So it's
exactly,
they're mirroring each other. So unless there is, as the town manager mentioned, some additional
utility purchase or something.
Yes, yeah. That changes our inflationary growth, then this solution should last more than the 20 years because they're both based on inflationary increases.
No, that's a very good point. Yeah. No, I agree.
Councilmember Solomon.
I think this approach obviously has the merit of offering stability and a lot less uncertainty over time. The difficulty is explaining it. This is now public record. Come August, there's going to be people who oppose this who are going to be showing that we want $23 to $80 million more, or they're going to state the council's going to increase spending by that amount of money. So that's an issue that we have to be aware of, because that will happen, and this will be published, and that's what people will say is, oh, look, they want you to approve $38 million more in spending, a whopping 50% increase, or whatever. So that's just something that we have to consider in this. I mean, there, as I said, the benefit is this gives you long-term stability. All we're saying is it's absurd what the state did. Look at what they set our budget to back in 1979 with less than 1,500 people, no retail, no water, no parks, you know, really basically no services. And every 4 years, we have to go back and have the voters approve a reasonable limit amount, a budget amount for the community. So, you know, that is something, and that's something that needs to be considered. And it's unfortunate, but it's going to be whether there can be a good enough explanation. Or as opposed to what goes out on social media, and people love to hear that, oh, your politicians are raising your budget by $80 million. That'll fly through the community faster than a dust storm. So that's all.
Mr. Mayor,
yes.
And Councilmember Solomon, I completely agree with you that we have to have a good message. I believe we have that good message, and I believe that reasonable people will understand that message. And I think Vice Mayor Barrett was very astute in mentioning that there are going to be 25 or 30% of the people who've already made up their mind before we even tell them what it is. And that's okay. We don't need 100% people to vote for it. Our job is to tell the story. We have a good story. We've been good stewards, and we are simply doing an administrative thing that will ultimately benefit this community. So I do just want to add that we did forget to mention once the council, should you decide to put this on a ballot, the only role that both the council and the staff have in the election process is education. We cannot, by law, advocate for a vote. We cannot ask people to vote in favor of it. The only thing that we can do is explain why it's going on the ballot, what it will do, and the benefit of that. And so, of course, the town will ensure that all of its materials and presentations are in compliance with the law, and then that then makes it a decision for the voters, and that's where it belongs.
Any additional?
Yeah, I do. What's the timing that you would be looking at with this, the timeline?
Mr. Mayor, Councilmember Pena, we would need a council decision no later than your first meeting in May, sooner if there's interest in putting
May
it
or
on.
March.
I'm sorry, March. I'm thinking May, March. It's an M word, right? March. And then we have a very strict schedule that the that Pima County gives us in terms of when we have to have materials to them and publicity pamphlet, and we would start with the development of a communication strategy, relatively quickly, because the publicity pamphlets will be mailed in May?
June.
So we would want to make sure that we were out and about in the community and with all of our materials to educate in time, because as you know, a good chunk of our voters vote in mail-in ballots, which means that they will be getting them this year about the beginning of July, since the legislature moved up the election. So I would say that our heavy month of real education is probably going to be the June timeframe into, through July. So that would be our outreach effort.
I know this is going to be coming to the council based on the questions, comments. What I was hearing from the council is leaning towards supporting putting this on the ballot as a permanent base adjustment, probably leaning towards a more conservative number in that range of 1.4 to 1.8. I know the commission came in at 1.65. You ultimately will present something to the council. Kevin, again, thank you very much for your presentation and thoughtful responses tonight.
Thank you, Mayor.
Okay. I believe with that, we can adjourn the study session. Thank you, Council.